You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. Thanks for joining us. The JX starts today with the debrief, where JPR reporters discuss the stories they've been covering this week, including a teen court program in Del Norte County, a new fee on natural gas in Ashland, and the Forest Service firing employees in our region. I'm Roman Battaglia, science, environment, and politics reporter.
I'm Justin Higginbottom, public health and safety reporter.
And I'm Jane Vaughn, housing, homelessness, and education reporter.
So Jane, you published a story this week about a new teen court program in Del Norte County. First, what's a teen court?
It is basically what it sounds like. It is a court made out of teenagers, and the goal is to basically offer teenagers in trouble a sort of off-ramp or diversion point as they maybe are starting to commit some crimes and head down a particular path. The goal is to try to break that cycle and get them back on track. And so basically, if a teen commits a nonviolent offense, it can't be a felony, but if it's your first-time offense and you're smoking or you do some graffiti or you're fighting, you can then be deferred to the teen court program by police or by schools or other entities. And then there's a whole court of your peers to help you with that. And I should mention also it has to be voluntary. So if the kid doesn't want to do teen court, they can decline, and then they would go through the normal criminal justice system.
Interesting. Teen court almost sounds like it could be like a TV sitcom.
Yes, it does.
So how does the actual court part work then?
So there's a sort of intake process, again, with a teen advocate. And then there's a sort of judge who's a youth facilitator. There's a jury made up of teenagers. And then there's advocates rather than attorneys. There is a legal representative in the room who's an adult judge or attorney to kind of guide the process. But basically, the kids are trained to run the courtroom. And the focus is really restorative justice and harm reduction. The participant who committed the crime gets to speak for themselves. And it really starts with the premise that they did commit the offense. They have to accept responsibility to even get into the program. So it's not like a normal courtroom where you're trying to decide whether or not this person is guilty. They accept they did the thing, and now the question is what to do next. And so the jury will come up with a decision to help the kid correct the harm that they've done. So that could be writing a letter of apology, painting over the graffiti, attending mental health counseling, things like that. But it's all sort of teen-led, and then they only get one chance. So if you don't do whatever you're supposed to do to correct that harm, you can, you know, maybe go right back to the normal criminal justice system. And then the participants have to also get trained as jurors themselves, and then they will participate in at least three juries in the future. So there's sort of that balance there where then they're part of the process as well.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering, is like the jury is made up of people who were previously in the program, it sounds
right.
Like. And so then why does Del Norte County need this kind of program?
It's a small rural county with fewer resources. Almost 14% of people there live in poverty. There are some problems with substance abuse and trauma and neglect. I talked to the police chief in Crescent City, whose name is Richard Griffin, who said that a lot of kids seem to admire having a life of crime, or they grow up expecting it.
I've had kids tell me they couldn't wait to get their number tattooed on them in San Quentin because their parents did.
So that's sort of the perspective from his view, is that kids are sort of growing up expecting this sort of life of crime. So there's really a lot of community support for this teen court. They're really trying to make a difference and hope that this is a sort of better, even playing field, because it is your peers. It's not adults punishing you. It's sort of uniquely supportive. It's less judgmental, and it's teens your own age helping you through.
Yeah. And so have they started holding court yet? And do we know how it's worked so far?
They're scheduled to hear their first cases on the 27th. So Del Norte hasn't held their first teen court yet. I should say there are tons of teen courts, over 1,000 teen courts across the country. So it's not a new idea. Mm-hmm. But I did look also at Humboldt County, because they've been helping Del Norte start their program. Humboldt County started the first teen court in the state 24 years ago. And they've had only about a 9% recidivism rate over the years. So they have seen a lot of success. Yeah, so Del Norte is hoping, obviously, to have some similar success there.
Well, great. Thanks, Jane.
Sure. Roman, we're going to turn to you. You went to the Ashland City Council meeting this week, where the city voted on a new ordinance about natural gas. What does that new law do?
Yeah, so essentially this charges a fee for people who are building homes that want to install natural gas in that home. So if you install natural gas appliances in your home during construction, then you'll have to pay a fee per appliance that you install, like a stove or a natural gas dryer or a furnace, things like that. And so it's to encourage the installation of electric appliances instead, which are more environmentally friendly. You know, the city's trying to reduce their carbon emissions. They haven't met their own climate reduction target so far, and this will go into effect at the beginning of next year.
Okay, cool. So how much could home builders then be charged with this new pollution fee?
Yeah, it depends on what they install in homes. The costs are calculated using this formula that takes into account the carbon emissions of the appliance, the social cost of those carbon emissions, and then the projected lifetime of those appliances. So they give a few examples, like a typical gas furnace that would last 15 years. You'd pay a little over $4,000. For a gas stovetop, it'd be $400. A water heater, $1,300. So you're essentially paying for the costs of emitting that carbon from that appliance up front.
Okay, interesting. So what is the backstory behind this ordinance and how did we get here?
Yeah, so there was this youth group called the Rogue Climate Action Team that's been working and pushing for this for about 2 years now.
Wow.
Originally, they were pushing for an outright ban on new construction, commercial and residential, of natural gas. You know, eventually they got some form of it accepted by the city to start looking at it. It took a while as the city was looking at their legal options because they were worried about legal backlash. Eugene had a couple of years ago tried to pass a ban similar to what the youth group was proposing, but it got forced to a vote by the natural gas company Northwest Natural. And then a lawsuit in Berkeley, California, struck down a similar ban, and so Eugene backed off for now. And so in Ashland, they modeled theirs after one in Burlington, Vermont, and then the money earned from it will go to the city's low-income energy assistance program.
Okay, so that seems like a pretty big victory for this youth advocacy group. How are they feeling about this outcome?
Yeah, they're happy. They say it's a good first step. I mean, I think obviously it's not what they wanted initially. Mm-hmm. It still means you could install natural gas. Mm-hmm. You just have to pay more. And so we don't really know how much of an effect it'll really have. There's not a ton of new construction happening in Ashland, and a lot of local builders are to use all electric appliances, but this still could discourage the remaining builders from installing natural gas. Some construction unions were opposed to the ordinance, saying it'll increase the cost for people trying to buy homes. But obviously, it's kind of important to note that natural gas is usually more expensive to install than electric, so all electric homes are usually cheaper up front. So we'll have to see how much money this new ordinance makes starting next year with the construction happening.
Cool. Thanks, Roman.
So, Justin, you reported on some shakeups under the Trump administration that have started to reach our area. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so this has kept us pretty busy this week, which I think will be a theme coming up, changes in federal agencies and such. You know, how is that impacting our region? And the story I did earlier this week was on mass firings at the U.S. Forest Service. So this is part of Trump and I guess Elon Musk's effort at cutting the size of the federal government. So over the weekend, this is last weekend, thousands of Forest Service workers were fired. The Forest Service says 2,000, and union rep for the workers and that agency said 3,400. But, you know, at least thousands were fired. And those firings targeted people on their probationary period. So those are new hires that have been in their position generally for less than a couple years. Someone shared a pink slip with us, a pink slip that they got, and I'll just read from that. It says, the agency finds based on your performance that you have not demonstrated that your further employment at the agency would be in the public interest. And so that went out to thousands of employees. And according to the Forest Service, the firings, like that letter described, were due to bad performance, which I'll have more to say about.
Interesting. So you spoke to a couple of people who lost their jobs in our region. What did they have to say?
They had to say a lot. So the first thing they said was that the poor performance reasoning was really a pretense. I spoke to a program coordinator that helped to create partnerships and get funding and grants for wildfire mitigation and reforestation projects in the North State in Northern California. And she had that position for 1 year and 11 months, so just under the cutoff, I guess, for the probationary period. And she said that not only had she not had any complaints about her performance, but in that short amount of time she was with the Forest Service, she won multiple awards, and she shared, you know, documents showing that she got that award. So we checked that. A union rep for the Forest Service workers said that she found in a lot of these cases that there weren't any actual performance issues. So again, they're saying this is just an excuse and a pretense. She also said there were a number of people fired that shouldn't have been listed as on their probationary period. So some had worked for the Forest Service for decades, but they had recently changed positions and so were in their new position for a short term. And it looks like, according to her, they were listed as being on probation because of just a clerical error. And that includes actually some who were months away from their retirement. So not only, according to her, not only could they lose their retirement benefits after decades at the Forest Service, but also because they were fired for performance issues, from what I understand, it's more difficult to get unemployment. So people are struggling to get unemployment after they've been
let go. Wow, that's interesting. So the Forest Service says they were fired for bad performance, but they really were not performing bad at all.
Yeah, or there's no evidence of them having poor performance.
So you mentioned in the story that this might also have an impact on firefighting in our area.
Yeah, so the termination letters didn't go out to firefighters and law enforcement. A USDA statement alleges that no operational firefighters were fired, but you know, many Forest Service workers, even if they aren't labeled as firefighters, they help in some ways when a big fire occurs. It's kind of all hands on deck when a huge fire occurs on national forest land. I spoke with a range technician for the Rogue River Siskiyou National Forest. So he oversees cattle grazing on that public land. He's actually the only one that goes out into the field to repair fences and do vegetation surveys and things like that related to grazing. They already have a pretty skeleton crew there. Mm-hmm. But he's also a former hotshot and wildland firefighter. And he said that when there's a fire, he'll go out on fire assignments. And that's a similar case with his other colleagues. And, you know, at the least, you know, if they're not fighting fire, they have a supporting role for the fire crew. So he says it's not really true that no firefighters were impacted by these terminations. Mm-hmm.
So even if no, like, people who are labeled as firefighters were fired, you know, people who might not be labeled as firefighters right now and go out on firefighting duty may have been fired.
Right.
So what comes next then?
So the Forest Service Workers Union has sued to challenge these terminations. We'll see if a judge thinks this is all legal. In the meantime, the union, or this union rep rather, says there will probably be more firings. They're expecting more rounds of terminations. And it's all just kind of up in the air right now. All of a story today, hopefully, on the funding side of this, a lot of grants and funding has been paused for work in our forests, especially related to wildfire. But I think it's important for people to realize that, you know, the administration has this goal of shrinking the federal government. Many voters wanted this, and they're not going in with a scalpel right now at this point. They're just kind of going in with a bat and just smashing a lot of things up. And we don't know what will stick and what will be reversed. If you remember last time Trump was in office, this would happen often. Some big change would happen and then it would be reversed or not implemented. So, you know, there are real impacts right now on the ground, but it's still extremely early to know what will shake out.
Got it. Great. Thanks, Justin. So, Jane, you also did some more coverage about homelessness in Grants Pass. What happened this week?
So two things happened this week. The first is that there's a new lawsuit pending against the city from an Oregon disability rights group and five homeless plaintiffs. They claim the city's treatment of homeless people violates state law. And so on Tuesday, a judge extended a temporary restraining order in that case. They had an old one, and now there's a new one for another 10 days, which basically says that homeless people can't be cited, arrested, fined, prosecuted for camping for the next 10 days. It's through February 27th at this point. And the other thing that happened this week was that the city council expanded some public camping options for homeless people at a Wednesday night meeting. So now they have more choices of where to camp.
Great. And just give us a little bit of background on the situation here.
Yeah. So that lawsuit was filed at the end of January. Again, claims the city's treatment of homeless people violates state law. And so what's happening is in response to the lawsuit, the city council is now trying to expand their public camping options for homeless people, which is what they did on Wednesday. They're trying to put themselves in a better legal position. So they reopened a site near City Hall on 6th Street, which had previously been open. So they reopened that. They're going to continue to allow camping at a site near the police station on 7th Street. They also extended the hours that campers are allowed to be at each site. So it's 4 days now that you can stay at those sites. People were also talking at the city council meeting about being really angry. They're sick of this sort of ongoing homeless problems in the city. And last June, Grants Pass had won a different case over its treatment of homeless people. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in its favor. And so some people say, we already won that case. Why do we have, you know, why are these problems still happening? But this is a separate lawsuit. It's a new case. The argument in that first case focused on the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment, which the city won. But the argument in this case is about state law. So it's a different legal argument. It's a different case. And also, the city recently had a years-long injunction from that first court case be lifted, which had prevented the city from enforcing its public camping ordinances. That was just recently lifted. And so now the city's trying to put itself in a good legal position again in this new lawsuit to prevent the current court case from leading to another injunction.
Great. Thanks, Jane. We'll keep following this. That's it for the debrief this week. Thanks for listening. You can reach the newsroom with comments on our coverage and suggestions for things we should cover in the future through our news tip line. It's on our website at ijpr.org. And you can find this program and more at jeffexchange.org or subscribe on Apple, Spotify, and all the other platforms.